Matter of State versus Khalil Cooper. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Stephen W. Kirsch, designated counsel for Mr. Cooper.
Jennifer Farina, on behalf of Friend of the Court, the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Assistant Prosecutor Milton S. Leibowitz, on behalf of the state.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Kirsch.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I will ask for 2 minutes of rebuttal, if I may.
That's fine.
Your Honor, whenever the legislature drafts or passes a criminal statute and inserts into that statute predicate offenses, they do it one of two ways. The much less common way is to use a catchphrase. Originally in the NERA statute, when it was first passed, it said any violent crime. In State versus Lanahan, this court dealt with a situation where you had to interpret what an offense in violation of public safety would be. That particular methodology requires this court or some appellate court to step in and determine what that means, determine what statutes fit that bill, what ones don't. But the much more common way is what was done here, which is to enumerate the specific predicate offenses. This court has also been clear 100% of the time that when the legislature enumerates the offenses that way, that is the list. It isn't any bigger and it isn't any smaller. You don't add to the list, you don't subtract from it. In this particular case, the crime at issue is 3330, promoting organized street crime. That is a conspiracy among defendant and at least two other people, with defendant in a role that we are somewhat familiar with from the Kingpin statute as an organizer, supervisor, financier, manager, etc., to commit one of the predicates. Every single one of those predicates is a substantive crime. Conspiracy is not listed as one of those predicates. Now, why would that be? Well, if you go back to the conspiracy statute, 265-2, it covers a lot of ground, covers a lot of possible conspiracies. It does not cover a conspiracy to conspire. In this particular case, how did this play out? Trial judge goes to charge the jury or has a charge conference, looks at count four, 3330, sees that what the state has done is indict in a very sloppy manner. They have put as the predicate offense of 3330 racketeering under 2C41-2. Racketeering isn't on the list. Everyone agrees racketeering is not a predicate of 3330. So what the judge does, I don't have a problem generically with it, but I do have a problem with the specifics. And what I mean by that is the judge looks at that particular indictment, that particular count, and says, what is the defendant on notice of? That's okay. And the judge decides the defendant is on notice of racketeering as the predicate. So we're going to go to the racketeering count, and we're going to take those predicate offenses and import them in over here into 3330. So far, that's okay if those are actually predicate offenses of 3330. The problem is the three predicates of racketeering here are conspiracy to murder, substantive aggravated assault, and conspiracy to distribute drugs. Only one of those is a valid 3330 predicate, conspiracy to commit the substantive crime of aggravated assault. Ultimately, defendant gets acquitted of the conspiracy to murder as a predicate, acquitted of the aggravated assault as a predicate, and convicted only of conspiracy to distribute drugs as a predicate crime of a conspiracy among two or more people acting as an organizer, financier, manager, et cetera, to commit a conspiracy to distribute drugs. Now, what does that mean? It's an agreement, because all conspiracies are agreements, to do something in the future. Ordinarily, conspiracies under 5-2 are conspiracies to commit a substantive crime. Instead, this is an agreement to agree. Is that wrong? Yeah. Is it charging a predicate offense that isn't on the list? Yeah. So in any criminal appeal, this court's going to have to decide three things. Was there error? Was it harmful? If it was harmful, what's the remedy? Where the state is hanging its hat here, I think entirely, is on the notion that this was no big deal. It might have been a mistake, but it wasn't harmful. Here's why that's wrong. An agreement to commit a substantive crime of drug distribution means two people get together, they say, we're going to do this thing in the future sometime. Problem is here, the agreement is not to commit the ultimate crime, it's just to agree that later we're going to do that. Now, that's one step removed. It is a different act. It is an agreement simply to agree. We've all said it at some point. We're going to agree later. That's what was charged here as the underlying predicate. Now, why does that matter generally? Because the defendant was convicted of a crime that doesn't exist. More specifically, in this particular case, did that harm the defendant's case? Yeah, because the jury received an instruction that said an agreement to agree would be good enough. Look at the way the state tried its case when you're evaluating harm here. And this is not a criticism of the way the state tried its case, but they choose a particular path, they have to live with it at trial and on appeal. What they did here was, instead of some more typical RICO prosecution method, which might involve a turncoat witness or might involve an undercover cop, those people would go into the organization and report on what they saw and heard. Here you have phone calls and phone calls and phone calls. 300 some phone calls are played for the jury. There is no turncoat witness. There is no undercover cop. This is done solely through phone calls. And those phone calls, do they mention heroin, cocaine, marijuana explicitly? No. They talk in other terms. The state wants you to believe that those are code words. Okay, they can make that argument. But what could the jury have done here with this? There were many, many, many phone calls between defendant and a number of different people referencing things like, sometime we're going to need some more of the white girl or the white boy, meaning allegedly heroin or cocaine. Is that a conspiracy to distribute drugs? Maybe the jury could find that, I guess. But what could they also find? They could also find, I don't know if they actually agreed to a substantive crime, but they certainly agreed to agree. And that's where the harm is here. This jury was told, you must return a guilty verdict if you find an agreement between defendant and two or more people, with defendant acting in one of those kingpin kind of roles, to agree to distribute drugs. Could that have hurt this case? Absolutely, it could have hurt this case. That could have resulted, that has the clear capacity, that charge, to affect this verdict and convict my client of a crime that doesn't exist.
The state says that a conspiracy to conspire is not an agreement to agree at some later time. Instead, it's an agreement by two or more people that they already have agreed.
That is the state's argument on page 11 of its brief. That is 100% wrong, and here's why. A conspiracy is an agreement to do something in the future. Ordinarily, that thing, I think all the time, that thing is commission of a substantive offense. When you agree to commit that substantive offense, has that substantive offense already occurred? No. So when the agreement is merely to agree to commit a substantive offense, has that second agreement already occurred necessarily? No, not any more than in an ordinary conspiracy. The state seems to be saying that when you conspire to something, that something has already occurred. That's not normally true. A conspiracy is about future action. The problem here is the future action is not a substantive crime as charged to the jury. It was just another agreement. Now we have an error. We have harm. Clear capacity to influence a verdict for a crime that doesn't exist. What's the remedy? I say this somewhat sheepishly. I asked for the wrong remedy in the appellate division. I was raising multiple jury instruction errors, the ordinary, 99 times out of 100, probably much more than that, the ordinary remedy for a misfire on a jury instruction is a reversal, remand for a new trial. as I was typing up the brief in this court, dealing only with this particular jury instruction error, I started to type reverse and remand for a retrial, and I thought, what are we retrying? We're certainly not retrying 3330 with one of the other predicates, because defendant was acquitted of those. Are we going to retry him on a predicate that isn't a crime? No. Is he on notice of any other predicate? No. Now, what
the relief you seek, if I understand it correctly, is that the conviction on count four be stricken.
Yes.
And that there be no retrial on that.
Yes.
Count. Have we made things a little too complicated in terms of error, harm, and remedy in this sense? Your argument to the court is this defendant was convicted of a crime that doesn't exist.
Right.
He was sentenced to jail for a crime that doesn't exist.
Right.
Isn't that the end of the harm analysis? How can that be harmless error if your position is correct?
It can't be. It can't be. When I was...
We need to look to the calls. We don't need to look to the potential for confusion. If somebody went to jail for a crime that doesn't exist, that answers the question
yes.
of whether the error was harmful.
Yes. And I thought I said at the beginning of my harmlessness argument, but maybe I passed over it, which is the initial harm is being convicted of a crime that doesn't exist. However, if you delve into the specifics of the evidence in this case, you can absolutely see how that happened through this charge and through this evidence. And that was my point in terms of, look, it really actually appears to have influenced the verdict here, above and beyond the more generic version of the error or the harm that Your Honor is speaking of. In terms of the remedy, he can only be retried for something he was indicted for. He was only indicted with notice of two conspiracies that shouldn't have been predicates and one substantive crime that was a predicate. As I understand the state's argument at the very end of its brief where they're saying, no, send him back for a retrial, I think they're talking about retrying him with the predicate of distribution, actual substantive distribution, as the predicate crime. That's not indicted. This jury never considered that as a 3330 predicate. Because remember, 3330 is not just an ordinary conspiracy. It's a conspiracy with two or more other people acting as a kingpin-like person, financier, manager, supervisor, et cetera, to commit the predicate. Did this grand jury indict defendant for actual substantive drug distribution as that predicate of 3330? No, they didn't.
Was your client convicted of drug distribution? I thought on.
I don't think he was. I think he was convicted of, in count 23, I think he was convicted of conspiracy to distribute drugs. However, I will note to Your Honor that is a very different kind of conspiracy. That is simply a conspiracy between defendant and one other person. It requires none of the kingpin type elements.
And then the other charge, the only other conviction was for possession of cocaine.
Yes.
Count 11, right?
Right.
So there was no conviction on count 12 or 13, which would have been the actual distribution offense.
Right. And completely ignoring what appeared to be the advice from the chief, I'm going to go one step further on that, because you are absolutely correct. That's the simple answer. The even more complicated answer is, even if he had been convicted of distribution of drugs, the grand jury did not consider that as a 3330 element, because they would have had to consider all the other elements of 3330, the more than two-person conspiracy, the kingpin elements, all of that with respect to actual substantive drug distribution. So it just, there's nothing left to retry. Unless Your Honors have anything else, I don't.
Before you sit down, tell us your position on the line of cases from the Third Circuit, Pungentour in particular.
I'm sorry, the line of cases?
The line of cases in the Third Circuit, Pungentour, the notion of a conspiracy to conspire. Are you familiar with Pungentour?
I am not, I'm sorry to say.
Then that's the answer. Other questions, anyone?
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Ms. Farina.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jennifer Farina. I'm with the law firm McCarter & English, and we represent Friend of the Court, the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey. I will endeavor not to repeat the points ably made by Mr. Kirsch, but I would like to emphasize why the issue before the court today has broad importance and warrants articulating a clear general rule. If allowed to stand, the state's interpretive approach will undermine fundamental canons of statutory construction and could introduce ambiguity into all manner of statutes with predicate offenses. So we ask the court to step in and make sure that that does not happen. In our view, the jurisprudence in this state already establishes that where a criminal statute contains a list of predicates, the list must be limited to its plain meaning and not expanded by implication. We cited those cases in our brief. The defense cited those cases in its brief. And yet we find ourselves today in a situation where the state is again attempting to expand a list of predicates beyond what the statute actually says. And that approach has been endorsed by the courts below. This time, the state is attempting to broaden the statute by borrowing the notion of conspiracy from one element of the crime and carrying it over to other elements of the crime. And it's asking it to do an enormous amount of work in shaping and broadening the meaning of those other elements. The court should not condone that type of borrowing when construing criminal statutes. Creative interpretation like that departs from the plain language, and it's not a good basis to distinguish the prior cases in this state and existing law narrowly construing lists of predicates. The court should require the state to operate within the language of the statute as written, and we believe a clear rule is necessary to guide parties in the future and to dissuade the state from putting forward similarly tortured statutory interpretation in other cases. We also believe a clear statement is necessary because there are implications for the many statutes that involve predicate offenses. These include other leadership-type statutes that aim to impose heightened penalties on leaders of various criminal endeavors. And also many sentencing statutes contain the lists of predicates like Mr. Kirsch was referring to. The state's interpretation here could introduce ambiguity into all of those types of statutes. Finally, I would like to remind the court, as Mr. Kirsch did, that the state is asking for permission to impose criminal penalties on conspiracy to conspire and agreement to agree. And the hazard here is significant because it would punish conduct that is yet one step further away from an actual criminal act with even less fully formed criminal intent. To put a finer point on it, it means the state can secure a conviction where there's no underlying substantive crime, no conspiracy to commit a substantive crime, but merely a conspiracy to conspire would be enough. This raises serious policy concerns about where on the continuum between general criminal intent and the commission of a crime, conduct becomes punishable. And when there are these types of competing policy considerations at stake, it is especially important to honor the legislative intent by hewing to the language that the legislature crafted. If the legislature weighs the competing interests here and concludes it wishes to criminalize a conspiracy to conspire, let it say so explicitly. It has not done that here, and we ask that the court not do that either. For all of these reasons, we urge the court to issue a clear directive that where a criminal statute contains a list of predicate crimes, that list must be limited to its terms and cannot be expanded by implication. I thank you for the opportunity to appear today on behalf of the ACPL-NJ. I'm happy to answer any questions, and otherwise that concludes my remarks.
Your third argument with respect to the double VIN-code offense, I want to find out how far that extends. Racketeering conspiracy is an offense under the criminal code. Can a predicate of a racketeering conspiracy charge be a conspiracy?
The first place always to look is the language of the statute itself. So I did cite a case in our brief dealing with federal RICO statutes where the language of a RICO statute committed underlying offenses that expressly included conspiracy. So
do you see a problem with that? Because you came out arguing against double in-code offenses as a general proposition. Is there a problem with the racketeering conspiracy charge on the books?
That certainly exceeds the scope of what we were arguing today. I think that step one is to determine whether the legislature has authorized this as a crime that can be prosecuted. It's possible, I think, in scenarios of double and co-ed crimes that they would implicate questions of, you know, notice and due process and punishing conduct that is too far toward the merely preparatory and too far away from an underlying criminal act. But that is not what we are arguing is the case here today. And you know, the double and co-ed offenses have, in certain circumstances, been recognized, but that's not what has happened with the statute at issue here.
So you're refining your argument. You're focusing your argument only on the promotion statute.
Our focus is on the promotion statute and a clear expression of the rule about how narrowly you need to identify these predicates. And the policy considerations that I raise about the weighing, the reason I mention those is because that's a weighing that needs to take place in the legislative process and in crafting and carefully defining where on this continuum we want to identify criminal activity begins.
Maybe I misunderstood. It sounded like Mr. Kirsch was arguing, and you agreed, that conspiring to conspire is not a criminal offense, cannot be a criminal offense. And it sounded like, and that's one of his arguments, it sounded like you were agreeing with that, but now you're saying if that's listed as one of the predicate offenses, it can be a predicate offense.
If it were listed as one of the predicate offenses, certainly the textual and statutory interpretation issues we have here today would not be present. I think it would raise other issues of due process and whether the two conspiracies in the lair actually exist, you know, sufficiently independently of each other, and whether the underlying conspiracy actually itself constitutes enough of a substantive offense that those two can work together.
You're not disagreeing with Mr. Kirsch, you're just not relying on that as the basis for dismissal in this case.
That's correct.
I understood your brief to say this court should reject conspiracies to conspire. Do you hold to that position or not?
That goes a little bit farther than the position we're taking in our brief. The position we're taking in our brief is that conspiracies to conspire are so delicate and so fraught with policy concerns that it should be left to the legislature and not read into statutes by way of jury instructions in a trial court.
Yes, but if there's a problem with a conspiracy to conspire, how is it cured by the fact that the legislature inserted it?
I believe in the context of, that's been addressed in the context of RICO statutes, where when you look at them more closely, you see that the targets of the conspiracies are perhaps slightly different from one another, and they're able to work together in that way. I will confess that's not something I've explored in great detail.
I take it you agree that we don't have to address that question in order to resolve this case.
That is our view.
Other questions, Emily? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Leibowitz.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The state respectfully requests that you affirm defendant's conviction because the appellate division correctly found that NJSA 2C33-30, promoting organized street crime, criminalizes a conspiracy to commit a wide range of offenses, including distribution of CDS. Indeed, despite defendant's claim that conspiracies are not included in the statute, every violation of promoting organized street crime is a conspiratorial offense. That is because the statute, in plain language and in no uncertain terms, states that it is a conspiracy. It begins by saying a person promotes organized street crime if he conspires. And therefore, the state respectfully submits the question before this court is whether or not the language used in this case was erroneous. The question is whether or not stating conspiracy twice in the instructions defining this statute caused harmful error. And the state submits that the answer to that is no. To begin, the repeated use of conspiracy was harmless because it merely identified the conspiracy that was being alleged. It was akin to almost a stutter. More importantly, I think three things from this case also lead to the conclusion that it was harmless error. First, a conspiracy to commit a conspiracy is just one ongoing conspiracy. The state argued in its brief and continues to argue that a conspiracy to conspire is an agreement that you have agreed, not an agreement to agree. In fact, I think in one of the cases that Amicus cites from the District of Colorado, I believe it's U.S. v. Exceler, the court comes to this conclusion that the reason we don't need to have a conspiracy to conspire is because where you meet that first overt act for the first conspiracy, you've established the substantive crime of the alleged second conspiracy, and they essentially bind into one. And therefore, a conspiracy to conspire, as instructed in this case, was harmless because it essentially folded into one ongoing conspiracy. And as previously stated, a conspiracy to distribute drugs is criminalized under this statute. It's also harmless error because in this case, the jurors sent 13 notes during the trial. They did not ask anything about this instruction. While admittedly some of their notes were about procedural issues, scheduling, wanting read back, or whether or not they could have the ammo with the gun, the fact that they asked questions shows that if they were confused, they would have inquired. Indeed, they inquired about the languaging of racketeering. They did not ask any questions with respect to this statute. But perhaps most importantly, we know that the jurors found the elements of this offense as they should have been instructed, based on the verdict that was rendered. Promoting organized street crime requires the jury to find that defendant conspired with two people to distribute CDS and that he conspired as a manager, promoter, organizer, or financier. It is clear that the jury found defendant conspired to distribute CDS because they convicted him of that offense. And the alleged taint associated with this conspiracy to conspire in no way affects their clear finding that he was a manager, organizer, supervisor, or financier of that conspiracy. Therefore, upon looking at the verdict that was rendered, there really is no question that the jurors found what should have been instructed, and thus the conspiracy to conspire that defendant alleges is harmless. With respect to Amicus's argument that we have a double incohate crime here that is particularly problematic, as previously stated, a conspiracy to conspire folds in upon itself into one ongoing conspiracy. It doesn't present the concerns associated with an attempted conspiracy or an attempted solicitation, a desire to conspire, or things of that nature, because by its very construction, a conspiracy to conspire is one ongoing conspiracy. And it is clear that the legislature criminalized conspiring to distribute CDS as part of promoting organized street crime. Admittedly, it requires you to move the conspire at the beginning of the language towards the predicate acts, but I would submit that there is no question that promoting organized street crime criminalizes conspiring to distribute CDS, which was found here. In sum, the appellate division properly found that NJSA 2C3330 criminalized the conduct at issue. The instruction in here was harmless, and this court should affirm that finding.
Counsel, yes. Just looking at the statute itself, is conspiracy to distribute CDS a predicate offense under the promotion of organized street crime statute?
I would submit it is, Your Honor. It is not enumerated.
Tell us where.
So it is not enumerated in the section of the statute that lists the chapters. However, the instruction needs to be read as a whole.
Don't go to the instruction. Look at the plain language of the statute.
Yes.
And tell us, where is it in the enumerated offenses that one can find conspiracy to distribute CDS?
It is not in the list, but I would submit that it is criminalized behavior. And again, I know Your Honor said don't go back to the beginning, but I don't think one can ignore the beginning, where it states a person commits this offense by conspiring with two or more other individuals as a manager, financier, promoter to commit this offense. It is key and incumbent that there is this conspiracy. And if there is no conspiracy, it is not a violation of this offense.
So let's parse the statute a little bit further.
Yes, Your Honor.
It says a person promotes organized street crime if he conspires with others as an organizer, supervisor, financier, or manager to commit any, and I'll modify the language, of the following crimes.
Yes.
Conspiracy to distribute CDS is not listed in any of the following crimes, is it?
I agree that conspiracy is not listed in the following crimes.
Now tell us what the jury found as a predicate offense in this case.
Conspiracy, they found that defendant conspired to distribute CDS. And insofar as such conduct is criminalized by this statute, where you were acting as an organizer, financier, manager, or promoter, it would meet the definition of this.
Respectfully, that's not what the jury told us they found. The verdict sheet, question 10B, tells us exactly what the jury found as a predicate. I'll read it for you. They found conspiracy to distribute a controlled dangerous substance as the predicate. That's not listed as a predicate in the statute.
I agree with your statement, Your Honor, that that is what they found as they checked that on the verdict sheet. That was what they were instructed.
So it appears that they found an offense that is not a crime. How do you get around that?
I would have to go back to my earlier argument that the criminalized conduct that the legislature intended was conspiring to distribute CDS in this role.
We look for the legislature's intent from the language that it used in the statute. Are you asking us to look beyond what the jury actually found here?
I'm asking the court to look at the effect of what was instructed. And
before we get to the instruction, it appears, to keep this very simple, that the jury found this person guilty of something that is not a crime. Is that an incorrect reading of their response on the verdict sheet?
I think looking at their response on... It appears that, yes, they checked the box of conspiracy to distribute CDS, which is not listed as an enumerated offense in the statute.
Why isn't that the end of the analysis?
Because the question is whether or not the conduct underlying that was intended to be criminalized by the legislature.
But if the legislature wanted to criminalize conspiracy to commit the substantive offenses listed, the legislature could have easily noted that in the language of the statute. The statute criminalizes as predicate offenses a pretty broad range of offenses. Any crime specified in chapters 11 through 18, 20, 20, 33, 35, 37. If the legislature wanted to include... including any conspiracy to commit those offenses, it could have done so, and it didn't do that.
Agreed, Your Honor. I would say that the problem here is that this was, unfortunately, an amendment during the trial, which defense counsel admits he doesn't have a problem with procedurally, as defendant was on notice for the racketeering activities. The court, in attempting to fashion the language that should be used to instruct the jurors here, took the distinct predicate acts for the racketeering and plugged them in here. And I think it went a step too short, which is causing this error. I think the court could have merely stated, this is a conspiratorial act. Conspiracy is recognized in the beginning language, the introductory language of the statute, and then instructed it as distributing CDS. And we wouldn't be here, or at least not for this reason, had the court elected to do so, recognizing defendant was on notice.
But wasn't defendant actually acquitted of distributing CDS? That's what I'm not sure about with any of this argument. If your argument is, you know, this is really not a problem because conspiracy to conspire to distribute CDS is the same thing as just conspiracy to distribute CDS. And so we have the conspiracy in 2C33-30, and then we have distribute CDS as the predicate offense. Wasn't the defendant actually acquitted of distributing CDS?
Count 12.
Yes, he was.
So then how does that help you?
Because, again, because promoting organized street crime is a conspiratorial crime, The fact that he was acquitted of the substantive offense doesn't mean he was acquitted of conspiring to distribute CDS, and he was actually found guilty of that.
But if your point is that conspiracy to conspire to distribute CDS is exactly the same as conspiracy to distribute CDS. That's your point, right? It's just a stutter. Using the word conspiracy twice has no meaning. It's exactly the same as conspiracy to distribute CDS. So if we take you as at your word and we look at the statute and we say, okay, we have the word conspiracy in 2C:33-30. So we're just going to pretend that the predicate offense was actually distribution of CDS, not conspiracy to distribute CDS, so that we aren't accidentally repeating the word twice, and we have the predicate offense that you're saying really existed, defendant was acquitted of that predicate offense. So the jury obviously did not think that conspiracy to distribute CDS was the same as conspiracy to conspire to distribute CDS. Otherwise, he would have been convicted of the predicate offense.
I followed you up to a point, and then I guess at the end, you lost me. I view it as they acquitted him of the substantive crime. There was no evidence that they found supported him actually distributing it. But in, I believe, count 11, they found he conspired to distribute CDS. And when I say that the conspiracy folds upon itself, it removes one layer of conspiracy. So it is clear that they found that he did, in fact, conspire to distribute CDS.
So are you arguing that if the 2C:33-30 had been charged as conspiracy to distribute CDS without the word conspiracy twice, so the conspiracy and then the predicate offense is just distribution of CDS without any repetition of words, and that if defendant had been acquitted of the underlying predicate offense, are you arguing that under 2C:33-30, he could have still been convicted of promotion of an organized street crime? It just would have had no predicate offense because he had been acquitted of the predicate offense?
Yes, insofar as because it is a conspiratorial act, he did not need to complete the actual distribution to be found guilty of it.
But here it was, the sentences were consecutive, right?
Yes.
So wouldn't that obviously be harmful then if he had been convicted of a predicate act that didn't, in your view, you know, he could be convicted of promotion even if there was no predicate act, but here it was consecutive sentences. So there's both, there's double counting.
It is a potential incongruity, but if he's being acquitted of the distribution, there wouldn't be anything to run it consecutive to. So that concern wouldn't come into play.
Just to correct a statement that I think you made, you said count 11. I think it was count 23.
23.
Is the conviction for conspiracy to distribute, but he was acquitted of the possession with intent to distribute, which was count 12 and the 500-foot charge.
Thank you, Your Honor. That is what I intended. I believe count 11 was the possession of CDS, and I think that's what...
Isn't there another problem with removing the second reference to conspiracy, and that's what notice did the defendant have of the charge? Count 4 speaks to a pattern of racketeering activity as the underlying predicate. And if you look to the earlier counts, which define the pattern of racketeering activity, conspiracy to distribute a controlled dangerous substance is listed, but not distribution. So you can't just amend it at the 11th hour and charge the defendant with something that he has no notice of. How do you remove the extra word, which really changes the crime?
The defendant was always on notice that we were charging him with a variety of crimes, including distribution of CDS. I agree that...
But not in count 4. Look at the language in count 4 and tell us what he was on notice of. Page 7 of the indictment.
Here. Yeah. purposely conspire with others as an organizer, supervisor, manager, financier to commit a continuing series of crimes which constitute a pattern of racketeering activity.
Stop there. And as a result of that, counsel and the judge together discussed referring back to that phrase, pattern of racketeering activity, that is defined earlier in the indictment. I'm looking at the language in count one, but it repeats itself. You can't find distribution there. Defendant's entitled to notice of what the charge is.
I agree, Your Honor.
Did he have it? Did he have notice that he was responsible under count four for a distribution offense as a predicate?
Insofar as they amended it and the conspiracy was in there, yes. Insofar as it being explicit that it was not a conspiratorial offense, no. So to answer your question simply, I would say no.
What's the appropriate remedy in this situation if the court finds that there's a flaw with count four?
If the court finds that the flaw is he was convicted of a crime that doesn't exist, it has to be vacated, as you cannot convict him of a crime that doesn't exist. And if the amendment was improper, as he doesn't have sufficient notice, it cannot be remanded for retrial to fix something that doesn't exist and therefore, again, leads to vacation of the conviction. Unless your honors have any other question, I think that is all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
First, do you have a rebuttal?
Only on the issue that you raised with amicus.
I just wanted to talk about racketeering for a second. I don't profess to be an expert on racketeering. I've never had a client actually convicted of racketeering, but I have read the racketeering statute, and what I see in that is, I think if we had had a racketeering conviction here, I'd be making an argument to you that the wrong predicates were charged there when they charged conspiratorial predicates. At least as to the count of racketeering that was a conspiracy to commit the racketeering offense, the underlying racketeering predicates. If you look at 41.2, I'll start with 41.1. 41.1 enumerates a bunch of predicate crimes for racketeering. Conspiracy's not there. Just substantive crimes are listed in 41.1. Then if you jump to 41.2C and also D, which is what was indicted here, C is the substantive commission of those crimes as a pattern of racketeering. D is a conspiracy to commit those underlying crimes as a pattern of racketeering. Nowhere in there do I see room for a conspiracy to conspire to commit those crimes. So I think it's a lot the same as 3330. I don't profess to know at all what the feds have done with this, and maybe their RICO statute is different, I don't know. But it doesn't look like our 5-2 or our RICO statute allows for a conspiracy to conspire. I think it allows under 41-2D a conspiracy to do any of the predicates that are listed in 41-1. And I think it allows, obviously, a substantive commission of those predicates in 41-2C. But I don't think it allows a conspiracy to conspire because conspiracy is not listed over in 41-1.
But that's a statutory interpretation argument. I had not understood you to be arguing that it would be unconstitutional if the legislature had listed in 2C 3330 conspiracy as one of the predicate offenses.
Unconstitutional, probably not. No, okay. I've never gone there. I think this is easy because it's not on the list.
Understood.
But I think racketeering probably also would be just as easy because it's not on the list. And the conspiracies to commit racketeering are covered in 41-2D. They are solely conspiracies to commit that list of substantive offenses that's over in 41-1, of which conspiracy is not one of them. Unless your honors have anything else.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.